from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The world did not change in a flash on August 28, 1963. From the centuries of racial oppression and discrimination and division this country had known. But hopes and dreams and determination did change on that day at the March on Washington. And real change followed to a point. What is that point? The point we're at now on race. This hour on Point, we honor that day by taking stock 50 years later of what we have and have not overcome. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Where are we today on freedom and equality? Where have we come? What remains to be done? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on that day in this famous passage.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
It was an epic moment, and now, 50 years later. Joining me now in the studio is Brandon Terry, age 29, African-American. He's a prize fellow in economics, history, and politics at Harvard University, doing postgraduate studies in philosophy and African-American studies. Brandon Terry, welcome. So good to have you here today.
Thank you.
From New York, we're joined by Reniqua Allen, journalist and fellow at the New America Foundation, doing postgrad work at Rutgers. She's 32, born 18 years after Martin Luther King's great speech. Reniqua Allen in New York, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, great to have you here. And finally, from Durham, North Carolina, Eduardo Bonilla Silva joins us, professor of sociology at Duke University, author of Racism Without Racists, American of Puerto Rican descent, 51. Eduardo Bonilla Silva, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
Eduardo, let me come to you. I mean, you were just still a baby at the time of that speech, but time moves forward, and here we are. When you think back on that hope, that dream, the promise of that day, you look at all the change that's happened since then and where we are now, an African-American president who will speak on that site today. What do you think about where we've come and where we have not?
Well, much has changed, but much remains the same. So the change is visible. We have Black and Latino middle-class folks in corporate America. They can teach at Harvard or Duke University. Mm-hmm. And some even may become the president of the United States. But the condition of the masses, the Black and Latino masses, is as bad as it was 50 years ago. And even the members of the Black middle class working at Harvard or Duke experience discrimination. So let's remember that just a few years ago, Henry Louis Gates was racially profiled in his own house. And I can attest that as a Black-looking Puerto Rican man, I experienced discrimination inside where I work at Duke and outside. So, for example, I go to stores often, particularly nice stores to buy presumably quality items. And often I get the, may I help you? May I help you? May I help you? So it's a new way of discriminating, of letting us know that they're following us. And many of us experience harassment by the campus police. So much has changed, but much remains the same.
Brandon Terry, let's go right to you. You're 29. Eduardo says there's still discrimination there, more subtle, more nuanced maybe at places where he is at Duke, at Harvard. You're at Harvard. You're 29. Do you feel discrimination in some way? I mean, after all, you're at quite a place.
Well, things are very, very complicated. You know, there are certainly instances of discrimination where, particularly for persons at, you know, these top-tier institutions or in corporate America, where there's a lingering suspicion about your intellectual capacities or your deservingness for, you know, whatever role that you happen to have. And these are, you know, these are suspicions that are sort of inherited from not only a lingering kind of racism, but also as a response, a response of white racial resentment to programs that have developed in the wake of the civil rights movement.
Affirmative action.
Exactly, exactly, mm-hmm. to respond to racial inequality. So there are those forms of discrimination. But, you know, it's obviously true that the opportunities available for African-Americans have expanded enormously. But what's still the case is that the wealth disparities have increased since 1980 between blacks and whites. We're facing something that Martin Luther King and his cohort could have never imagined, which is the massive expansion of the system of incarceration in this country and the amount of black men and black women who are conscripted into this carceral system, mm-hmm. and stigmatized in ways that, you know, amount to the sorts of exclusion faced by African Americans in the South in the Jim Crow period. I would hesitate to call it precisely the new Jim Crow, but it's a metaphor that's provocative because it has some resonance of truth.
It is millions of people behind bars. Renico Allen, there you are in New York. I mean, we want to look very clearly at what remains to be done here today. We also want to take real pride in what's been accomplished. How do you look at that balance, Renico, from your perch?
I think it's really a tough balance to have. So much has been done. Obama is president. I think that gave a lot of people hope and a lot of people change. But I think it's really confusing for this generation. We still talk about race and this kind of black-white dynamic and this very – we look at race in this way that's looking back. We haven't really found a way to advance the conversation. We're living in a society that on the surface in many ways looks like there has been change. Looks like there has been accomplishment. But it's also very hard for us to see that there's so much segregation that still exists in society. Even though segregation is technically illegal, we see it in our schools, we see it in the prison system, we see it in our culture, we see it in our prison systems. It's invisible in some ways, and I think it's really hard for us to deal with. It's really hard for us to balance because there does seem like there has been change, but we have a very, very long way to go.
So we don't want to – I mean, looking back, there's real value in it because that is real history. It has shaped a lot of the ground we stand on. Looking back and understanding it is always important. We don't want to be prisoners of that. If we have a new reality, let's move into it. If there are better things about it, let's fully inhabit those. I mean, Brandon – if that's there, if there's a new kind of relation that's not so black and white, is that a healthy thing? Is it wallpaper over the masses Eduardo talks about, over the nuances where there still may be unease? Or is this the new ground, the new opportunity to move on and up from? How do you look at it?
Right. Well, I mean, we just have to be precise. So there's significant changes in the ethnic and racial demographics of this country. That's undeniable. There's a massive influx of Latino citizens.
In recent decades, yes.
Right. There's a great increase in the number of Asian Americans. There's an increase in the number of blacks who are from Africa or the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And so these present us with all sorts of interpretive difficulties about how to understand the society. But I really, really want to insist that demographics aren't destiny. Mm. So you see a lot of this commentary that's like, well, you know, there's going to be this new coalition for the Democrats that will ensure a permanent Democratic majority.
The country's so diverse now that reality will change, has changed.
And that is so – I mean, it's such a naive view of the way that the racial order has developed in American history. You know, race is not a static category. It changes. How people think about racial categories evolves over time. And so what we may have, if we're not sort of thinking critically about these categories, is a – shift in what exactly constitutes the racial hierarchy, but still a light to dark hierarchy, or still people who are totally excluded from the society based on ascriptive characteristics mediated by, their class position.
Eduardo, we just have a minute before the break. Are we moving forward to a new American United States, USA, freedom and equality? Are we moving sideways to a kind of Brazilian hierarchy of color?
Yeah, Brandon hit the point right on, that the assumption that minority folks are going to be the majority in 20, 50, 30 years is problematic because race is a construction. And I fear that we may become Latin America-like, which for some folks is like a great development. But in truth, anyone who knows about race matters in Latin America knows that race and racism in those countries is much harder to fight than it is here. So becoming Latin America-like is not a great development. So I remain pessimistic about the future of race in America.
Eduardo Bonilla Silva, Reniqua Allen, Brandon Terry, it's good to have all of you with us on this profound anniversary of a profound moment in American history, the March on Washington, Martin Luther King's great I Have a Dream speech. Mahalia Jackson behind us right here, she, the one who said, tell him about the dream, Martin, tell him about the dream, and he did, and it pushed a lot of history before it. You can join the conversation this hour. Where do you see racial lines in America today? Where have we overcome them? Where have we not? Will you be meditating today on Martin Luther King and his great speech, his dream? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go back once more, August 28th, 1963. This is On Point. We're looking at where we are as Americans on race 50 years after the March on Washington. Odetta there singing August 28th, 1963. We're looking at what we have overcome, what we haven't, how things have changed. We're at 1-800-423-8255, and you can join us. Where do you see racial lines in America today? Progress, its opposite. Where are we on Martin Luther King's great dream? Here's Martin Luther King on that day in the opening minutes of his I Have a Dream speech.
When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Martin Luther King, 1963. With us today, Brandon Terry, 29 years old. He is a prize fellow in economics, history, and politics at Harvard. African-American Reniqua Allen is with us, 32, journalist, fellow at the New America Foundation, with a good eye on all this. She's studying representations of middle-class black Americans in the post-Cosby show era. Eduardo Bonilla Silva is with us from Duke University, professor of sociology there, 51, also just a baby in 1963, but time passes. Time marches on. We're looking back at the March on Washington, 800-423-8255. Brandon, Reniqua, Eduardo, lots of response online. Will says everything still needs overcoming. This is not a place of this land is your land. Buy Skittles with a hoodie and being black can get you killed. But David writes, the biggest obstacle is to forget about racism and stop the mainstream media from promoting it. All kinds of attitudes on this 50th anniversary. An African-American president speaking today in front of the Lincoln Memorial, that has to be seen as progress in its own right. But there are many, many millions of Americans and many millions of realities here. Let's go to our listeners. Buffalo, New York. Bob is calling. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I think before we move forward, we have to honestly look back and honestly deal with the history of this country, which we have not yet done. this and this date in 1955 was the death date of Emmett Till. Last Saturday was the one march that we had, and there's another march today. But we haven't looked at how this country was built on oppression. It's not so much about racism. It's about freedom versus oppression. And this country was built on oppression, and it's a history that it does not want to honestly look at so they can honestly address it and honestly move forward.
But, Bob, how can you say after 50 years we haven't looked at it? I mean, we have talked a lot about race in 50 years. We've made progress, not perfect, but looked at it, not talked about it. I feel like we've talked a lot.
We haven't talked about the honesty of the oppression of humanity in this country. We still want to couch it in a racist thing, black versus white, rather than quote, really addressing it as wrong versus right. A people were kidnapped for hundreds of years, were brutally treated, enslaved for hundreds of years. Native American people were wiped out on the basis of their of the support of a white supremacist, white domination kind of thing, or European domination, all based on finance. We have not honestly looked at it. We've couched it in ways that we can be comfortable with it and we can move forward and still have the same same lingering effects, lingering impacts, because we haven't honestly dealt with it.
Bob, we've got it. We've got it, and we've got it very clearly there, and I appreciate your call. I mean, the enormity of our history when it comes to these issues is not easy to take on board. But Eduardo, surely we've put a lot of collective effort into this as a nation for 50 years at least now. Are we still evading something in our history that requires yet more confrontation?
Well, I'm afraid that we're evading a lot. But in the questions you got and the comments posted, I think that one of the problems we're having is that when we talk about racism, Black and Latinos and minority folks have a view of racism that is different from whites. For whites, racism is prejudice. And based on that, they believe that there are fewer prejudiced people in America. Therefore, we basically are a post-racial nation.
Okay.
For folks of color, racism is systemic racial practices that maintain white privilege. And by that metric, we can claim that racial inequality today corresponds to systemic practices in housing, in the labor market, in the education, etc. So that conversation cannot be an honest and deep one until we begin by sort of agreeing on what is the subject that we're discussing.
I mean, Reniqua, there you are at the New America Foundation studying at Rutgers. You know, you, like many others, have made wonderful progress in life. But when you look around in a clear-eyed way, do you see systemic, Eduardo would say racism still?
Absolutely. I mean, we can't overlook the fact that brown and black communities, living in these communities, they're not valued the same way as living in a white community. I mean, that's very systematic. You see housing values. Our communities, we are not valued. We see our culture. We don't see ourselves represented on network television. Very, very few. So we're as a society, it's seen as we're not valued.
Have you looked at the award ceremonies for American popular culture lately? African Americans are all over them. You might even say dominant.
I think that that's a problematic thing. I mean, you always see African Americans historically in entertainment and sports. We're still
but
very
underrepresented. But you said not represented in the culture. And I mean, maybe that's the wrong metric, but that's a very prominent feature of our culture.
Our culture is segregated. When you look at music, sure, you see African-Americans sometimes. But you look at network television, for example, and this is what I study at Rutgers.
Okay.
You don't really see African-Americans. Very, very few on television. I mean, Scandal, one of these shows on ABC, is one of the first network shows in something like 40 years to show an African-American woman in a lead character on a drama. That's problematic. I'm not talking about kind of being segregated to shows on cable or BET, but looking at African-Americans, looking at Latinos is a mainstream part of our culture. We don't see it. We don't see middle-class families. We don't see poor families. We don't see brown and black families generally and their culture represented on television. I think that some of the problem is, and it was alluded to before, we see, and certain people I think see our society in this kind of post-racial way. So they think if you see a black person on television, if you see a black person on film, that means that we're represented, that that's diversity. And that's not true because we're not seeing our culture. You can't just put a black face on television or a black person on film and say that that's diversity. It's not. It's not embracing our culture. It's not representing our culture, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I understand, Brandon. I mean, there's been so much talk about diversity in these decades. I think a lot of Americans will hear what Ronique was saying, in some sense, get it. On the other hand, say, wow, you know, we feel like we've been at a decades-long kind of, enlightenment course on diversity. Maybe we're bad learners, but there's sure been a lot of talk about it for a long time.
Sure. But in some ways, I mean, there's a segment of the African-American intelligentsia, of which I would probably count myself as part of, that considers the diversity, the proliferation of diversity discourse, as in some sense a distraction, right?
So how can that be? What do you mean?
Well, there's a way in which you can talk about diversity that precludes you from talking about inequality. So if you read the Bakke case, so in 1978, UC Board of Regents versus Bakke is what defends affirmative action. Okay. And the justification is Judge Lewis Powell writes this opinion, the controlling opinion. And in it, he cites Harvard's admissions policy.
Okay.
And Harvard's admissions policy treats diversity as the reason for considering race. And they put it in a paragraph that compares it to growing up on a farm in the Midwest or sort of having other kinds of experience that we can treat. And we've seen it go out of control with this. So it's, you know, now we have conservatives arguing, well, we need diversity of thought, as if that's, I mean, we all think differently, right? I mean, that's by definition thinking. So, you know, the question then is, well, if you're talking about everybody's just different and what we want is a lot of different perspectives and however different they may be, what we're not talking about is why aren't there many African Americans in elite education, right? And it's because of enormous obstacles that we have inherited from systematic discrimination.
Do you mean in the ranks of students or in the ranks of professors?
Both. I mean, both.
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 Are they not there when you look around at yours? Or, Ronique, when you look around where you are, do you not see African Americans in the ranks of those students and teachers there?
I mean, look at University of California system, where African Americans have virtually disappeared from the top tier institutions.
And how do you explain that?
Well, they've gotten rid of affirmative action there. And so now people aren't considering the sorts of obstacles that African Americans are confronting as they navigate the educational hierarchy in this country. At Harvard, for example, we got about 10% of the student population is black, but it's not African American. It's not descendants of American slaves. I mean, maybe 10% of the 10% is that.
But Eduardo, let me put this to you. Our listeners are keying in here. Shag writes, he says, white flight, and maybe this is related, and the death of cities like Detroit and Milwaukee shows that racism is alive and well in America, he writes. If people of means don't want to live in a multicultural environment, they won't. They'll move away and take their tax base with them. Racism is a choice, maybe even a freedom that cannot be taken away. But then another listener writes in response, white flight is not racism. Many ethnic groups, including blacks and gays, for example, self-segregate. He says to the earlier writer, he says, I think you're conflating class issues and race issues.
That's the way that the race talk has evolved, yeah? So from the Jim Crow prejudice of the past, we have developed a new ideology, if you will. I call it colorblind racism. So rather than talking about race directly, we talk indirectly. And we know what folks are talking. So when someone says, I am moving out of this neighborhood because I have class-related concerns such as crime, I'm concerned about property values, that is a new way of talking about race, yeah? Of course, after people get two beers in their system, they tell you the truth, and they tell you, yep, too many blacks in the neighborhood. But we have a sanitized, seemingly non-racial way of talking about race, but most of us know that the discussion on neighborhood, for example, is about, although couched as a class concern, is a race concern. So that is part of the pessimistic stance that I have, that it is really hard to combat this sort of new racial formation, if you will, because it's slippery, it's hard to call it racial, you know. How can I go to a court and claim discrimination based on the fact that I went to a store and the clerk told me three times, may I help you, may I help you, may I help you? So prima facie, that is not discrimination, even though that is the contemporary way of letting us know we're checking you.
Let's go to Casey in Augusta, Georgia. Casey, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you see out there?
Well, I'm a truck driver, and I drive all over the country. I recently was through Detroit, and it looks as though a bomb has gone off and blown people out of the city. It doesn't appear to me to be an issue of black and white so much as it is an issue of poor versus the rich. It's a financial issue. It doesn't really appear to me to be a black and white issue. And if the blacks and the white poor people would come together and work together, I think these issues could be straightened out. But unfortunately, the South is always painted as being the racist part of the country. But in many cases, the big cities, the big corporations that run the big cities up north are more racist than
Yeah, Casey, you're breaking up on us, but we appreciate your view. I mean, you're a truck driver, you're right out there, you're looking at it. Eduardo, this is kind of to your theme, but Casey says, on the other hand, he doesn't see race first of all. He sees class first of all, and he sees, you know, white people in that underclass as well.
Yeah, but Casey has, I think, a different point, an important point. And the dream, my dream, somewhat different but related to Martin Luther King's dream, is that poor people of all colors will unite for racial and social justice. The problem is that although plenty of poor whites exist in America, and in terms of absolute numbers, there are more poor whites than poor blacks and Latinos. Mm. The fact is that whites still, even poor whites, get a slightly better deal in America and therefore exhibit prejudicial views. Now, he made a comment that is very important, which is the assumption that prejudiced people only live in the South, yeah? And here the joke that Malcolm X made was accurate, yeah? So the border the border of America in the South begins in Canada, which for me means that he didn't know enough about Canada. Had he known about Canada, he would have said, go a little bit farther north.
Well, I'm trying to figure where we go with that. I mean, Reniqua, is this all palpable? Is this all, you can only understand race in America today if you sit way back and look at the demographic numbers? Or is it palpable day to day, the reality we're talking about?
I think that the reality, I think it's absolutely palpable. I think it's more than demographics. I think it's really hard to understand race. I think it's very complicated. You look at the numbers, and it's really discouraging. I think a lot of people are down. You look at the divide on racial attitudes. Black and white and Latino Americans, we're vastly divided. You look at things like the Trayvon Martin case and the George Zimmerman case. Blacks in white America saw that in completely different ways. We're very much racially divided. But I also want to speak to that comment about class because I think it's important. And I think, especially when thinking of the African American middle class and looking at the growing Latino middle class and talking about movements, I think it's going to be harder to really get a active and get a new social movement going that really is on the ground and fighting for opportunity and pushing racial justice. I think that we still have a really hard time with the black middle class, and I think that the black middle class is struggling, but it's really going to take, I think, working class and poor people to form a coalition and to really get justice for everyone.
I want to ask you why that might be harder now. We'll come back right after our break. Reniqua Allen, Eduardo Bonilla Silva, Brandon Terry, please stand by. Behind us here, Bob Dylan with Joan Baez behind on August 28th, 1963. Listeners, where are we on Martin Luther King's dream? Have we even now got it all out on the table? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK.
All the fools will rise with the sleep still in their eyes, and they'll jerk from their beds and think they're dreaming. But they'll pinch themselves and squeal, and they'll know that it's for real the hour that the ship comes in. Then they'll raise their hands, saying, we'll meet all your demands. But we'll shout from the bow, your days are numbered. And like Pharaoh's tribe, they'll be drowned in the tide. And like Goliath, they'll be conquered.
Will the circles be unbroken? By and by, Lord, by and by.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about where we are as Americans on race 50 years after the March on Washington. The ideas, the dreams, the inspiration of that time coming down over decades now to us. There's Richie Havens in 2009. We're looking at what we've overcome, what we haven't, how things have changed. How they have not. Brandon Terry is with us. He's a prize fellow in economics and more at Harvard. Reniqua Allen's here. Postgrad student at Rutgers, journalist and fellow at the New America Foundation. Eduardo Bonilla Silva is with us, professor of sociology at Duke University. You can join us. Where are we now on Martin Luther King's dream? Here's a big chunk from that day, August 28th, 1963.
When we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Thank God Almighty, he knew how to use the language and all of our heritage right there on that day. And it did propel a lot of change. But here we are, it's 2013, and we are anywhere but maybe the promised land. Lots of progress, though. Reniqua, I want to come to you on this question of freedom. Martin Luther King talked a lot about it. It resonated with a lot of people. Today it's interpreted in many ways. You've got liberals who say, you know, we won't be free until we have social justice and economic justice. You've got conservatives who say freedom means freedom from government intervention on these things. It means freedom for everyone to stand or fall on the content of their character without regard to color. Where do you feel we are in terms of freedom from bondage to ideas of race themselves? I mean, that was part of what was implicit in what Martin Luther King had to say, that we would, you know, little children moving beyond that sharp sensibility of race, moving toward a unity.
Ooh, that's a good question. I think that where we are with freedom is, I see African-American youth, I see Latino youth, they just aren't able to exist. Not necessarily not be, you know, they're not able to exist and just be. They're not able to be youth. They're tied to over, you know, not even being able to walk down the street. They're not able to just be.
Because of their race, you're saying?
I'm sorry?
Because of their race?
Because of their race, absolutely. I think you really see it with Trayvon Martin. I think that really, really mobilized a young generation. They're afraid now to simply just walk down the street. Walking down the street with a bottle of iced tea, with Skittles, just being, just existing. They're not able to do that without looking over their shoulder, without worrying if they're going to be attacked, without worrying if what they're wearing is going to be problematic or someone's going to think that they're a criminal. I think that that's not freedom. I think that too many African-American youth in particular, but African-Americans in general, just can't be. And I think that's what the definition of freedom is. I think that's what Martin Luther King was talking about. And until we get to that point, I don't think that we are free as a society, as African-Americans, as brown people, as Latinos. And I think that's true for a lot of groups in America.
Eduardo, do you encourage younger people now to try and move beyond race? Or given the way your kind of pessimism here about the way things are going, are you still encouraging people to band together on the basis of race to look after their interests or something else, Eduardo?
Well, first, I said pessimistic. So.
Pessimistic. Your word. All right. Position. Pardon me. Yes.
Okay.
Little beach.
I encourage students to understand that race still matters, and it matters in everything we do. And going back to your question, larger question on freedom, I think that the biggest mistake we made as a nation 50 years ago was not developing collective practices, collective investment as a society to equalize as much as we could wealth, health, education, etc., so that we could then have sort of equal opportunity of life chances. So we've sort of removed some barriers, but left the vast differences in wealth, income, education, etc., in place, which guarantees that collectively, Black and Latinos are hardly ever going to win in the race of life.
Is that how you see it, Brandon?
Well, I think, you know, going back to that point that Casey, the caller from, the truck mm-hmm. driver made, and he was trying to bring up class as an issue. Mm-hmm. And one of the things
color lines.
Right. And one of the things that we have to be really, really careful about is that, I mean, he's making a critical point, but we have to join the analysis of race and class and other things as well, mm-hmm. gender, sexuality, mm-hmm. So that we really grasp not only that there are inequalities that emerge from the fact that corporations and the 1% control a disproportionate amount of resources, which then allows them to control disproportionately the levers of government and public policy. We also have to recognize that there are ways in which race interacts with that inequality to not only reproduce it in unique ways, mm-hmm. but also to prevent us from understanding exactly what's happening. So, you know, there's this debate about universal public policy versus race-conscious public policy. So mm-hmm. there are lots of people who are criticizing Obama for not talking more about race-conscious public policy. And, you know, I think what's driving that criticism, and rightfully so, is the idea that, you know, public policy has to have race as a category of analysis all the way through. You can't just say a rising tide lifts all boats. If you have a federal jobs program mm-hmm. that still keeps in place, restrictions on who you can hire based on felony convictions or drug convictions, mm-hmm. then you could have a massive jobs program that wouldn't affect many mm-hmm. African-Americans or Latinos mm-hmm. Who are facing that kind of criminal background. And then if you put that program into place and the unemployment numbers don't move, then all you're going to do is turn back to the old explanations. Well, these people aren't capable mm-hmm. of lifting up in any way. We've done everything we could and the numbers still won't move. But it's because you didn't have race as the right kind of category of analysis with your class analysis.
You get a kind of perpetuation right there structurally. Reniqua.
You know, I think that we're so afraid of race today. We're so afraid to admit that sometimes racially conscious public policies work. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the Voting Rights Act worked. The Civil Rights Act worked. Affirmative action did help African Americans attend school. And these enforcement policies worked. We're so afraid to admit that, because I think that if we admit that some of these racially conscious public policies worked, we're sort of admitting that there's some kind of inherent discrimination in our school, in our system. Mm. And I think we don't want to admit that. But I think that we kind of need to get back there.
But people would like to say maybe there was, but we're getting past it. We're getting beyond it. Let's everybody stand
we're
on
not,
their own
though.
2 feet.
Mm. We're not. You look at the numbers, and as we've mentioned several times during mm-hmm. this conversation, wealth is a huge thing. Wealth is huge. Our education numbers are still not where they should be. Voting, you know, we're doing good with voting, but there's still voting disenfranchisement. We are not where we should be. And the middle class, particularly the Black middle class, is in jeopardy. Even those that want to do right, even those that are trying to do right, it's something like a third still fall back. And this is a vastly different rate than white Americans. So I think that we really have to go back. You look at California school systems and without affirmative action, and we're seeing what's happening. So we have to go back and admit that some of these race-conscious public policies work, and I think that's because of this inherent and systematic discrimination.
And yet you must feel, you know, so many people who at least long that we could be at the point 50 years after mm-hmm. the March on Washington, that we would be beyond that, not necessarily in a racist way, that honestly hoping, wishing that people would be in a position today that wasn't necessary anymore. Reniqua, you're saying that's dreaming a little bit.
I do think it's dreaming, and it's really unfortunate. I think for me, looking at when Obama was elected president, I think that I thought that that was going to be one of these transformative moments. And then right after, you see so many things happen. You see Henry Louis Gates getting arrested. You see the Trayvon Martin. And I think we understand. You see the citizenship question around Obama and those issues that are very, very interesting that were raised. And I think that It's a great moment. It is telling on our society, but we have a lot of work to do. We are not where we should be.
Nancy in Somerset, Kentucky. Thank you for calling, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I was at the march. I was 14 years old. My sister was 13. She was the youngest from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And a 92-year-old African-American woman was the eldest. It was amazing. We came on school buses. It was a long, hard trek.
Yeah.
I don't know how the 92-year-old woman did it.
Yeah.
But I wanted to say what I feel I've learned in the 50 years is that it doesn't matter whether the president is black or white, and I don't need Hillary Clinton to teach me that it doesn't matter that it's a woman. I believe that it's exactly what people have been talking about, what the truck driver brought up, is that it's the rich and the poor. And that the reason so many African-American and Latino youth, including girls, are in prison is because they, being the establishment, know that that's where the rebellion is going to come from, that finally does change or overturn this system that perpetuates racism, that is fundamental to its existence.
You're talking about a day with Martin Luther King, a man who put peace, nonviolence, very high, maybe at the top of his pyramid of values. And 50 years later, you're talking rebellion, Nancy?
Martin Luther King was assassinated because he started bringing in the war against Vietnam. And he started talking about workers, the garbage collectors in Memphis. That's why he was assassinated, because he was bringing in the whole big picture. And Malcolm X was assassinated, and dozens of Black Panther leaders and rank and file were assassinated by the FBI and local police. It was the Black movement was beheaded, and it's taken a long time to recover, but I think that is why there are so many in prison, because they don't want that to happen. They don't want new leaders to arise.
Nancy, let us hold that thought and go to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Mark. Mark, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I kind of will be brief. The main thing that I want to express is what I hear from the people that you have there on your radio is a mentality from 30 years ago. I'm a 30-year-old white male here out of Tulsa.
Okay.
And I truly believe that America is what you make of it. We have an amazing country. We have a black president. We have people of all different races and colors and all different types of positions of power throughout the country. I truly believe that if you work hard, if you do what's right, and you take care of business, you're going to have the same type of opportunities across the board.
Look, let me ask you, Mark, it is an amazing country. There is no question of that. But what if you start from a position of disadvantage? I don't know, buried somewhere in Compton, you know, kind of deep in a community without good schools, without resources around you. What about that difference?
I was born poor, and I'm still poor by economic standards.
Yeah.
But I'm still a good father. I still make the right choices, and I do what's best by my children.
So do you think the answer is stop talking about this so much? Don't take the attitude that we're in trouble, just everybody on their own, go for it? Will that get us there?
No, I think that if they spend as much time building the others up around them,
yep,
as they do pointing out all of the differences, I think that you would have a better impact. I think that it would change things, and I believe that it's time to start changing that mentality.
Mark, I appreciate your call. Brandon, let me put that to you. Nancy says it's not going to change, we need rebellion. Mark says, come on, lift up the people around you, don't be shackled with this old observations, and let's go.
Right, well, I think Mark's point comes from a place of deep concern. Right. And what I would respond to it with is a plea that he understand that, look, we're talking about a civil rights movement that's always had two wings. Right. It's always been a dual project. It's been a project about demanding that the state live up to obligations of justice. And it's wrong for us to live in a society where once social mobility was the defining characteristic of the American class system to some extent, and the chances that if you're born in the bottom quintile of incomes, that you'll move out of that is at the lowest it's been in decades.
That should concern everybody.
That should concern everybody. I mean, that is, if there's going to be any practical faith that this is a democracy that's capable of accommodating values of the equality of opportunity and justice, that's got to concern everybody. Now, we also want to add an analysis of race to that, because there are ways in which there are additional burdens that fall upon some people that also need to be taken into account that can't be reduced to income. But we've got to be honest about that. Now, being honest about that doesn't mean that we sort of discard the values of you know, being committed to your familial obligations, being nonviolent, you know, caring about your community, engaging in sort of public service. I mean, these are all things that every civil rights activist cared about. These are people who started freedom schools to educate people and do the hard work of training people for literacy. They're folks who have done a lot of gang intervention work. Martin Luther King, when he went to Chicago in 1966, met with the gang members. He went down to the pool halls and the projects. He moved his family into the slums so that he could engage these gang members and try to persuade them to put aside a life of violence and drugs and crime and participate in a nonviolent movement for change. I mean, that's the tradition that we come out of. So nobody's rejecting that, but it's part and parcel of a dual strategy that needs to be recovered for this moment.
And from all that experience, a dream came. He shared it with everybody. He spoke of freedom. Freedom requires struggle to achieve it, to sustain it, maybe at every level. Individual to our friend Mark, collectively to our friend Nancy, and I guess that means nationally right there as well, altogether. I want to thank the three of you for being with us today on this big anniversary. Brandon Terry joining us in the studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Reniqua Allen in New York. Thank you for being with us, Reniqua.
Thank you.
And Eduardo Bonilla Silva in Durham, North Carolina. Thank you, Professor Bonilla Silva.
Thank you.
Listeners, good day to think on our country, its past and its future. Thanks for joining us. Sam Cook here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
But I know change gon' come.